Hello again. It's Jiryu here as part of our Breath in Buddhist Meditation online course. I'm really excited today to talk to you about something that's not exactly from the Buddhist tradition, but comes out in this weird way in the American Buddhist influenced world of psychology, actually, and meditation research. So, as this course has gone along, we've been talking about different kinds of meditation, different styles of meditation, and it can be confusing or complicated to understand how do these different forms of meditation fit together. As I said, I myself have been confused over the years trying to understand, well, is my practice a concentration practice? Is my practice a wide open, choiceless awareness practice? And by the way, which is the right practice? And why these people come to, say, San Francisco Zen Center, trained in a different tradition, why is what we do so confusing? And when I've gone to join the practice in other temples, in other meditation centers, why have I sometimes felt like, well, the practice you're doing is different from the practice I'm doing? So there are all of these styles of meditation, and part of the amazing thing about Buddhism in the West right now is that we have these vital living traditions of meditation practice, even Buddhist meditation practice, not to mention the range of other meditation practices that are available to people in this place and time. But these Buddhist traditions, all sort of the pinnacle, you could say, the culmination of centuries, if not millennia, of development in their respective countries, Tibet, China, Japan, India, all side by side, suddenly, in the same city, in the same town, you have various centers teaching various practices. So it's an amazing time right now in Western Buddhism, global Buddhism, really. Internationally, this is happening where there's an amazing and sort of unprecedented mixing of Buddhist traditions that have, in previous centuries, been isolated geographically to some extent. Obviously, there's always been some flow. And there's always been, even within specific traditions, some confusion or some complication about the different ways practice is talked about. The most clear, perfect summary and picture of this diversity of meditation practices, for me lately, doesn't come from Buddhist scripture or Buddhist teaching, although there are wonderful categorizations of the practices and teachings in the Buddhist tradition. But right now, for me, the most clear and most precise way of talking about the different kinds of practice instructions and also the different kind of meditative experiences is expressed by some work that's just now appeared in a journal of psychology. There's an article that's coming out, or maybe now has come out, in American Psychologist, by a group of amazing scientists and Buddhologists and thinkers and psychologists, researchers, authored by Lutz, Jha, Dunn, and Sarin, Clifford Sarin, who's been at the forefront of meditation research. They've come up with an article proposing a sort of theoretical model for identifying, pinpointing the different kinds of meditation instruction and the different experiences that meditators move through as they meditate. The world they're coming out of is the world of meditation research. We've all heard the occasional story about how meditation is great for your brain. There's a huge amount of research happening in this field, and there's some deep problems with the research that the researchers themselves acknowledge, and certainly that the Buddhist tradition has been offering, especially in terms of the definition of meditation. So we're studying meditators, we're saying meditation is great. What is meditation? Mindfulness, often we hear of mindfulness, but even mindfulness is a complicated and rich set of teachings in the Buddhist tradition. It's not one thing. Moreover, when you give a mindfulness instruction to, say, a room full of college students, which many of these studies do, if you're then studying what their brains are going through under the influence of this meditation, you also need to account for the gap, the difference between the instruction you've given and the actual experience that the person is having. So you may give an instruction in meditation and then get some sort of neurological data from that and assume that that correlates with the instruction you've given. But what it really correlates with is the experience that the person sitting has had of that instruction. So these researchers, deep in this field of meditation research, wanted to create some more precise model for understanding the instructions and the experiences of different forms of meditation. And I'm finding this extremely useful in thinking about meditation and thinking about what I do on the cushion and what I encourage others to do on the cushion. How do we move through these different spots? So they've created this wonderful map, and there's a version of it on our course website that I hope you can download, maybe even take the time to do that now, and pull that up. It's called A Phenomenological Matrix of Mindfulness-Related Practices. You may want to print it out during this short talk, or you may have a tab open where you can refer back to this matrix, this chart. It looks like this. At first, it may seem like there's a lot going on and there's some big words. I think as soon as we get into this, it'll become very clear what they're talking about. Very clear intellectually and also just practically true of our own experience. So I'm just going to dive into an explanation of this diagram. I'll refer to mine here, and hopefully you can be referring to one wherever you are. Are you there? Breathing with the body and mind of Buddhist study. What is meditation? So, here's this picture that expresses it. You may see the basis is this cube. It's a three-dimensional figure. And one axis here at the bottom is called object orientation. Another axis is called dereification. And the third axis is called meta-awareness. Big words, technical terms, to some extent coined by the authors, by the world that they come out of meditation, of psychology and meditation research. But again, quite simple. So each of these primary dimensions are assigned as a value from 0 to 1 on this diagram. So we'll start with object orientation. What do they mean by object orientation? Quite simply, what they mean by object orientation is the extent to which the mind is oriented towards an object. So when we sit, is our mind reaching for an object? Are we orienting towards an object? Simple. This doesn't mean, is the object clear? Not about whether the object is clear or not. That's addressed in a different place in the diagram. It just means, are we trying to find an object? So if we're doing, say, a concentrated breath awareness practice, our mind is looking for the breath. We're oriented towards the breath. If we're doing a wide-open meditation practice, our mind may not be looking for much of anything. They, in this paper, actually make the point that some Buddhist traditions, and I think Soto Zen would be one of them, holds that it's possible to have zero object orientation, to have the mind, the attention, not oriented towards any object at all. So in this chart, and it may not be clear quite yet, but OM stands for open monitoring, or what we've been calling shikantaza, objectless meditation, choiceless awareness. And FA stands for focused attention. So in the focused attention practices, the mind is directed towards an object. In the open meditation practices, it's not. But it's a continuum. It's not an either or. There's a range of possibilities of how oriented our mind is towards an object. They give a great example in this article of picking a face out in the crowd. And so I think it was very helpful to distinguish this clarity of the object from the orientation towards the object. So when we're looking for a friend in a crowd, we're looking around, can we see them? The mind is highly oriented towards finding this object, even though the object is not clear. Maybe we glimpse them, maybe we don't. The point is, how oriented are we towards it? You'll see also on this diagram, an addict, addictive craving, is a good example of strong object orientation. A mind wandering is like open meditation towards the direction of not really grasping for a particular object. That's one aspect of meditation. second aspect of meditation they call de-reification. So de-reification essentially is the extent to which we believe our thoughts. Do we believe that what we think is an accurate representation of reality? Or do we think that everything that we think and even feel is just a mental or emotional event? So they give the example, I have the thought, I am a failure. This is maybe a characteristic of what they call depressive rumination. I am a failure. Do we think that thought is a real comment on what I really am? Or do we experience it just as a mental event? This thought, I am a failure, has nothing to do with me or who I am. No more than the bird chirping outside has to do with who I am. It's not referring to something. They say at the highest levels of this de-reification, thoughts lose their representational integrity altogether. Every thought is just a thought. That is an apple. That's a thought. What is the apple? Really? So, highly de-reified thinking is also an aspect of our meditation that's cultivated really in all styles of meditation. For instance, again, coming back to the example of the breath, often when we try to find the breath and use the breath as an object of meditation, we can tend to, and I in my experience certainly have, made the breath into something that's really out there, really kind of get a picture or a view of the breath and think that that's what the breath is. So this de-reification is about our thoughts. It's also about, I think, something as concrete as the breath. Are we making that a fixed thing? Or are we present for it in a momentary way, free from views, really connected with the direct experience of it? Again, they have these great counterexamples on this chart, some meditative states and also what we'd call some unwholesome states. So addictive craving, for example, when you're addictively craving something, you don't tend to think, oh, that's just a thought. Oh, I'd really like a hit. Oh, that's just a thought. That's not the characteristic of an addict. The ability to say that's just a thought in the face of addictive craving is actually recovery, it's healing from addiction. So very low de-reification in addicts, obviously, in the addictive mind, which we all move through. And also in, see this FA, focused attention, novice, N-O-V. So the novice in focused attention, perhaps even a little more than the novice in open meditation, has a kind of reification, is believing in this breath, in the thoughts that are coming, not quite free. So this is another aspect that we can map our meditation on. Maybe we're very open in the sense that we're not going towards objects, but maybe we're still really sort of enticed by believing the thoughts we have. So this is another aspect, this multidimensional picture of what our meditation is. I'm finding quite interesting and inspiring. So the third primary dimension on this diagram is called meta-awareness. It just means background awareness, the awareness around the awareness. So it's particularly easy to see when we consider a focused attention practice. So we focus, say, on the breath, bring our concentration onto the breath. Is there also room around that concentration on the breath, around that awareness of breath? Is there room for sound, for bodily sensation, for something else happening than the field of awareness or concentration or attention that we've defined or prescribed? So the meta-awareness, how much space around the object, whether the object is a fixed kind of narrow object like the breath, or even if we're doing a kind of open practice. How much room is there around? So how strong is that? And again, in the experience of the meditator, you can plot this. How strong is my experience right now of metta awareness? Do I hear the sounds outside while giving this talk? And also the instruction. How strong is the instruction for metta awareness? So each of these, again, refers to our own experience and also to the instruction that we're receiving. The intention of our practice and the actuality of our practice, which may, as you know, not be exactly the same. This OM expert that you'll see on this chart has, of course, a very high meta-awareness. Anything that happens is absorbed immediately and clearly into the field of awareness. So those are the three primary dimensions on this chart. And I'll move quickly through the last four, and then we'll wrap up this segment. And this will explain the sort of strange pictures here that are plotting each of these states on this diagram. So there's a key off to the side that I'm reading from. The first is aperture, and that's indicated by the size of the circle. How wide is the circle? So aperture in focused attention or addictive craving, say, is quite narrow. It's a small circle. The aperture, the size of the concentration object, is narrow. Just the breath, just the hit, whatever it is, just the red-colored disc I'm concentrating on, whatever it is, a narrow attention versus a wide attention. I'm trying to include sounds. We practice in our Soto Zen tradition, for example, very strong emphasis on eyes open meditation. Again, eyes open already increases the aperture. Ears open increases the aperture. So how wide is our attention? Sometimes we may want to narrow it, sometimes we may want to widen it. A secondary aspect here is the clarity. And the clarity is expressed in this diagram by the cloudiness or clarity of the inside of the circle. So you'll see an expert in open meditation or in focused attention meditation has a very clear picture. The object is very clear. So even in open meditation, again, a useful distinction between spacing out. Spacing out lacks object orientation, just as open meditation does, but it also lacks the clarity. So open meditation also has this meta-awareness, also has this clarity too. So the clarity is how bright, how clear. I heard a sound, I really heard it. I felt a feeling, I really feel it. It's not this sort of vague, cloudy perceptions. The third secondary element is stability, and that's expressed by the darkness of the circle around each picture. So the stability is quite simply its continuity over time. So to be very clear and very aware and not believe a thought and have a very wide attention for a second is great. How persistent over time is it? So is that attention sustained or is it coming and going? Wow, I really, really felt that breath. That was amazing, but it's gone. So how stable is it? In Soto Zen, we say, just to achieve continuity is the culmination. So this speaks to that piece, the continuity. Is it momentary or is it continuous? And again, these researchers are interested in the brain, and obviously there's a difference between an experience that's momentary and one that's sustained. The final secondary aspect here on this chart is effort. And this is something that we've talked about in the course of this study of breath. How strong should our effort be? How strong do we want our effort to be? How strong is our effort? Should we have more? Should we have less? This is a point of real interest and even confusion for some of us at some times. You'll see in this picture, so the effort is expressed by this kind of basket that's under the picture. And the dotted line of the basket expresses very light effortless, almost effortlessness, you could say. And the stronger line is stronger effort. It's hard to overstate how confused I have been about this point. How strong should my effort be? You know, even so, we say our Shikantaza practice is effortless. But our Japanese Zen founder Dogen Zenji says, at the crown of your effort, make still more effort. There's this kind of ferocity. How does that relate to this effortlessness? So we can see in both focused attention on this diagram and in open monitoring, there is a softening of the effort as the practitioner matures. So effortless is generally good in Buddhism. But again, part of what I love about this diagram is the way it shows, illuminates these near enemies, what we call in Buddhism sometimes near enemies of wholesome states. So we may think that effortlessness is great. Effortlessness is like the Buddha way. Just have no effort. Just go with the flow. If you look at the example again of addictive craving, not a lot of effort. Doesn't take much effort to really want the next hit. Effortlessness as part of a package of qualities, of aspects of meditation that all need to mature together. So a novice, whether it's focused attention or open monitoring, has a very strong kind of coarse effort. And as it matures, whether it's a narrow focus in focused attention or a wide attention, the effort softens into a kind of effortlessness. And the whole range in between. I'm finding this diagram extremely helpful and interesting in terms of my own meditation practice, and I hope you have too. I think it's very useful in this diagram to understand the sort of trade-offs, not only the scope of the kinds of meditation available to us, but also the trade-offs. What are we valuing? What are we trying to do in our meditation? Are we going for clarity? Are we going for stability? Are we trying to make an effort? Are we trying not to make an effort? To identify these things and understand where we want to be on this chart and where we are. A final point, just in closing, is a point about liberation, as it's understood in the Buddhist tradition. So we see this chart and we might want to, as certainly I have been one who would have wanted to know, where is the right way on this chart? Where is the Buddha way of total liberation from all suffering for yourself and all beings? Where is that? Is it like a 0.75 metta awareness plus a 0.01 object orientation? Where's the sweet spot on this chart that's going to free me and free you from all suffering? Not on here. Not on here. Entering our life through each of these points. Each of these are possibilities of human awareness, human attention, and each of these is a gate into the wonder and mystery of what it is to be alive. So part of what I love also about having this all laid out is that we can see this is our field, this is our playground to move through. But liberation isn't owned. Liberation doesn't come through a particular spot in this. Liberation is something we cultivate and find wherever we are, through whichever of these gates we want to enter. I don't know if this was useful. I hope it was. I love this diagram. I'm very grateful to these brilliant authors, Lutz, Jha, Dunn, and Sarin, and American psychologists for putting out this really groundbreaking piece of work that I think will benefit the meditation community as well as the research community. Thank you for your focused attention, and I'll see you again soon. May our study, as always, bring benefit not only to ourselves, but really be dedicated to the well-being and liberation of all suffering beings.